So I think everyone knows, but some of you are new here. What we usually do first is we have a discussion period based on people's questions, and then we'll sit for 45 minutes, and we'll do a half hour walk, and we'll come back for another sit and have lunch. So this is the discussion period. So what should we discuss? Anybody have anything on their mind?
So I have a question about the dependent origination.
Yes.
So the first link is ignorance.
The
The
first
first
link,
in the cycle.
yes, it is.
But you know, I would expect that to be between sort of craving and clinging. So somehow the order of the links.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe a little background to those links would be helpful. When the Buddha spoke on a number of different occasions, he spoke in terms of links of dependent origination. And he spoke in terms of different links at different times. And so the 12 links is the result of going through all the different times in the sutras that the Buddha spoke in terms of of these links. And assembling them together and that gives us the 12. Traditionally, the 12 are divided into three sets. So the first and second comprise one set, and the 11th and 12th comprise a different set. So the first one you speak of is ignorance. And so that's a set that is kind of a summary of the whole process. And by the way, it has a beginning and an end, but it's meant to be understood cyclically. And so the first two links are a summary of the whole cycle. Okay, through ignorance, arises karmic becoming. Or with ignorance as a cause, there is the generation of karma that keeps us bound to the cycle of suffering or samsara. So those two are a set. Okay. Yeah. Does that help make sense of it? I could go on and talk about the whole 12 links, but
Yeah.
I have a tendency to do that. It's not necessarily what anybody wants when they ask a question. So if you think of it that way, and then you can think of the middle 10 links as a much more detailed description. And likewise, the 11th and 12th are once again a summary. The 11th is birth or coming into being, or the arising of the self, which is what the whole practice is about, transcending. So as a result of this birth of the self, this coming into being of the self. Good morning. Good morning. Please come in. There are lots of seats. Some of those three then. We're just talking about the links of dependent origination here, talking about the last two links. So as a result of 11, coming into being of the self arises as literally as it says in the sutras, this whole mass of suffering, sickness, aging, and death. So then you can take the 10 in the middle and you can see them as a description of the process that goes on over and over again throughout our lives by which we regenerate the karma that sustains the illusion of self, that leads to the craving that is both our both the cause of our suffering and the cause of the actions that we do to perpetuate our own suffering and the suffering of others. So I think it'll make a lot more sense when you go through thinking of it in terms of three step. The other thing that will help you is when you get to the third and fourth link, that can be confusing if you think of it as linear sequence, because the third link is consciousness, and the fourth link is nama and rupa, the five aggregates. But when the Buddha discusses these and when he's giving his talk about it, he doesn't say consciousness is the cause of the five aggregates. No, he says but it goes the other way too, that these two fold back on themselves. So with nama and rupa as cause arises consciousness. So these two are to be seen differently than as in a straightforward causal sequence. It's essentially the five aggregates. So you can combine those two together, or you can separate those two for closer scrutiny and examination. Or you can combine those two together and you can proceed with the rest of the link. When there are the five aggregates, when there is the nama and rupa consciousness, then within that are the sense bases. And when with the sense bases as a cause, there is contact and so on and so forth. And then you'll find it makes perfect sense. And not only that, it creates a really sensible cycle. You get to the end, you get to the 10th link, which is becoming and action in the world, which brings you right back to, once again, there will be some kind of contact with the sense organ and the cycle goes on over and over and over. I said I wasn't going to go into it in more detail. I did. How many of you are familiar with the links of dependent origination I'm talking about? Most of you. That's good. I apologize to those of you who said anything. What on earth is he talking about? It's a helpful tool that just describes the process that goes on in our mind by which, as I say, we perpetuate this process of suffering that we are trapped in. And people are fascinated by the links of dependent origination, and they often overlook the doctrine of dependent origination, the underlying, the large sense. The links are like they're a tool, but what's important is the notion of dependent arising, that absolutely everything is the result of cause and effect, that there is nothing that is not the result of causes and effects. Nothing stands outside of that. Yes.
I'll wait for the mic.
Yes, please.
We do this in London too. There's a real parallel there.
What that says to me is it must make sense what we do.
Yeah. Right. Somebody else is doing it.
That's right. Yeah.
So this is just a very general topic that I'm interested in, mm-hmm. and that Peter and I talk about a lot, and it's intention. Mm-hmm. And we were talking last week about intentions at almost like a subconscious level. It seems like there's a subconscious level of intention where there's an urge or a movement or what they might call volition at a level that's below our conscious, at any time, it's below our conscious ability to be aware of it. And then it seems like there's other kinds of intentions too, like a grosser level of intention or a more conscious level of intention that we use, for example, in the training, where we set intentions. And so I'm sure there's a lot that you can say about it. I don't have a particular question, but can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. First of all, all intentions originate in the unconscious mind, without exception. Any intention that you become conscious of has originated in the unconscious mind and then has become conscious. So it has originated with some part of the unconscious mind. And consciousness is how all the different parts of your mind communicate with each other. So when an intention arises in some part of your mind and is when it is projected into consciousness, then this intention, becoming conscious, means that all the different parts of your mind can examine that intention. And then they can play a role in determining whether you actually act on that intention or not. Right? So we all have this experience. We have intentions arise, and something tells us we better not go through with them. Or sometimes something doesn't tell us that, and we do go through them, and we wish, you know, we say, what was I thinking? Right? But, so intentions arise in different parts of your unconscious mind, basically as a result of your past karma. Because your past karma, everything that makes you what you are in a moment. Okay, so some part of your mind is driven by your past karma to formulate this intention and project it into consciousness. And then all the other parts of your mind have the chance to, they can reinforce that, say, yep, that's a good idea. Let's follow through with thought, speech, or action. Or they can say, no. Or, you know, in a sense, any intention you follow through on has received more yes votes than no votes, essentially. And you know from your own experience that you often have acted on this mixed intentions. You also know that you often have an intention and you're restrained from acting, and the restraint is also a mixed intention. There's still a part of yourself afterwards that says, I should have gone ahead and done that. So you can see the dynamic of what's taking place there. Different parts of your mind project an intention into consciousness, and the rest of your mind gets to have a say as to whether that intention becomes realized again. Okay, and the origin of an intention is your past karma. Okay, whether that intention is allowed to proceed or is negated, that is the new karma that you make in the moment. That it is that moment where the intention either gets the stamp of approval or gets rejected. That is your future karma. If that intention is approved, that intention is more likely to arise in the future, and it's also more likely to be approved in the future, and you're more likely to act on that intention. But if that intention arises and is rejected, then it is less likely to arise in the future. It's more likely to be rejected in the future if it does arise again. And so you have created a new karma, right? The karma is that you're less likely to have this intention, or if you do, you're less likely to act on it. This is the way the process works. Now, what happens over time is when the same intention gets projected into consciousness repeatedly and approved repeatedly, it can become habitual. it can become automatic. You will reach the point where the intention doesn't even become conscious until perhaps after you've already formed the thought, said the words, or performed the action. It's automatic. You don't become conscious of the intention until after the fact. As a matter of fact, if it's repeated often enough, the habitual nature of the intention will become so strong that you're not even aware that there was an option to do it or not do it. That it would, you know, it just, right? So this is how intention works. This is how karma works. This is how we shape the kind of being that we are. Over and over again throughout your day, in little tiny ways and in great big important ways. Everything from you have a thought and you dismiss the thought, as opposed to you have a thought and you entertain the thought and you get all wound up about it, all the way to, do I kill him or do I don't kill him? You know, every moment of your day, there are these kinds of intentions, small and large, arising in consciousness. And what you do with them in consciousness determines what kind of person you are, and they're probably the likelihood that they arise again in the future and that they'll be acted upon again in the future. So you're shaping who you are as a result of these intentions.
Yeah. If you were going to say more, then you should keep going.
No, go ahead.
If you were going to say more, then you should keep going.
I can say more endlessly.
I've become very attuned to the fact that everything I do is a comparison.
Is what?
Is a comparison.
Yeah.
I'm constantly comparing X to Y. And, you know, a lot of that's benign. And I've been telling myself that this is how we learn. I am now knitting better. Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of adds a comparison. And then there are comparisons that I could really do without, but it went by before I could even stop it. And now it's like I'm aware that there's a radio in the room that just never
there's shuts. What in the room?
It's a radio in the room that never shuts off. Comparison.
Yes.
And it's kind of annoying and kind of boring. And I would like to know, since everything seems to be discussed in the practice in terms of duality and craving and aversion, that's all comparison. How do we get under that? How do we start to break that?
What are we trying to break?
Comparison.
Why do you want to break comparison?
Because it seems like that's the underpinning of craving and aversion. I mean, really, if you go down, you're like kind of this atomic level.
No, it's not quite that simple.
Okay.
The thing is that you said it in the beginning, that's how you learn, it's a comparison, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, there is a point where comparison can stop, okay? When you've made enough of the right kinds of comparisons, when you've learned, when you have wisdom, when you have supreme wisdom, okay?
Good.
When you have shaped yourself to be the kind of person whose automatic behavior, whose intentions no longer need to appear in consciousness to be vetted, okay? Because the only intentions that arise are wise intentions, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, this is how a Buddha is described. A Buddha doesn't have to make decisions anymore. The Buddha has perfected his mind in the sense that, you know, whatever he says or does is based on the right intention.
So what you're telling me is I'm stuck with comparisons for a while.
Right. But the thing is, Yes, you are stuck with comparisons for all. And it's very important what you do with those comparisons, because you can also go the other way. You can also become somebody that doesn't make comparisons anymore, but acts automatically, entirely, you know, doesn't have conscious intentions anymore. But everything you do is motivated by the wrong intentions. You've shaped yourself into somebody, you know, so it's a blessing to be in the place to be able to make comparisons and to vet your intentions, so that if you have right understanding and if you have right intention, two first parts of the Eightfold Path, then you can make comparisons, choose the right direction, and shape and mold yourself. And if you do that, by the way, that's called mindfulness.
Yeah.
That's called mindfulness.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you have mindfulness, if you have right understanding and right intention, and you have developed the ability to be mindful, now you can make these comparisons in the right way, and you can shape and mold yourself till eventually you'll become a person that doesn't have to make these comparisons.
In the meantime, the radio continually plays.
Yeah, now your radio is something a little bit different, okay? All right. The comparisons are when you become conscious of an intention, and you also become conscious of the various possible ramifications of the thought, speech, or action that might flow from that intention. Okay, that's the comparison. Now, there's can be some part of your mind that is a self-appointed gadfly that doesn't necessarily have that much wisdom, but just has decided that their raison d'etre is to natter away about everything. That's the annoying radio in the background. You can let go of that. Because that's the thing. If you're practicing mindfulness, you don't need that. You don't want that, because that gadfly is full of judgments, full of doubts, full of all kinds of other stuff. You don't really want that. You want the kind of mindfulness you want is open, totally accepting, non-judging, and discerning. Okay, no judgment, only discernment. Taking in all the information. Okay, and the thing is that mindfulness too. A very important part of mindfulness, often neglected, is the continuing mindfulness. It's not enough to be mindful when an intention arises and you decide, okay, I will or I won't follow through on it. No, it's where it is really absolutely just as important that you be mindful afterwards as the consequences of the thought, speech, and action unfold, so that you have the mindful experience of, well, that might not have been the best way to go. Or, wow, that was really the right way to go. That mindfulness is really important. And likewise, even after you've made your decision, you've acted on the intention, you've been mindful of the consequences, then there's still yet another place for mindfulness. If the consequences of your thought, speech, and action were less than ideal, it is very, very useful to rehearse. I guess rehearse is for the future, reenact what is to go through how you could have done differently. What was the alternative choice that you might have made? If you actually take a few moments to live through that, okay? Now, this has to do, once again, with how intention is karma, and what you do with intention is making karma. So an intention was thrust into consciousness, it got approved, you acted on it, you realize afterwards, oh, better off I hadn't done that. Now what you do is you recollect the intention as it originally arose. And now you go through it again, only this time you reject that intention and you choose another path of action. You choose another thought, a different thought, Instead of one of anger, a thought of compassion. Or you choose either to not speak or to speak and say something differently, or either to not act or to act in a different way. You just go through the whole thing in your mind. Now, the same thing, what you're doing, you see that it's not quite as strong, but it's almost as strong as making the right decision when the intention first arose. If you'd made the right decision when the intention first arose, you would have made some strong karma of the right kind. You would have been more likely to make that right decision in the future. You didn't. You made the wrong decision, so you made some wrong karma. But if you take the opportunity to be mindful afterwards, and if you think about how you could have done differently, it may be only a shadow of the original event, but it's not a meaningless shadow. It's not trivial. If you sincerely have a sense of regret for having made the decision that you did, and imagine yourself as having made a different decision, you've made some of the same good karma, and that is going to make it easier for you to make the right decision next time.
Is there a way to kind of dial down the gadfly just a little? I mean, even when you say, yeah, oh, I made the right decision, that little voice is going, oh, yay, let's talk about that. Well, let's not know.
It's always helpful to think of these things going on in your mind as if they were a group of people. So you've got a group of people working together, and you've got this one person in the group that's doing this thing. What does that person want? Why are they doing it? Don't shake your head. They want attention.
Right? Yeah. Okay.
And even though other people get annoyed at them, they don't stop, right? Why?
Yes.
What
yes.
they want, yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah. What's the most effective thing you can do?
Well, you've got your choice. Ignore them or give them more attention.
Right. So ignore them. But your ignoring them doesn't have to be an aversive ignoring. It can be a tolerant ignoring. It can be a loving ignoring. It can be a yes, yes, yes.
I can just see myself saying that type of stuff.
Yeah. Well, if you treat that gadfly part of yourself in that way, it won't go away. It's part of you. But it doesn't have to always... if you give it a different kind of attention... And you can train it to be different. You can train it not to be, I mean, you know, after all, it is trying to help anyway, right?
Yeah. But
its wish to help is badly contaminated by its desire to receive attention or to be in control or to be the one whose decision is as acted upon, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just noisy. It's just noisy. Right.
The world's full of people like that. And, you know, you have to make it a decision about something, and they're the always ones that said, I think we should do such and such. And they're the ones that, if you don't do that, they never let up, right?
And if you do, then, right. And it doesn't come out, then there's, yeah. You know, I told right. you so about that. Right. I thought about that.
Well, if you're really wise, what you can do is you can recognize the part of that, let's talk about a person here, that part of that person that's good, the intentions that person has that are well-meaning. Mm-hmm. You can see the unhealthy needs of that person, and you can see that perhaps those needs can be met in a different way. You know, you can work with that person through loving kindness and compassion and patience and so forth. And at the very least, make them less of a pain in the ass. And at the very most, maybe cause them to become a really useful and helpful part of your team, your group, right? The same thing's true of that part of yourself. It's not going to go away. It has a right to be there. It has a right to be the way it is because it was shaped by past experiences. But you can love it into being much more helpful than it is. But as long as you think about, and you approach it with aversion, you're giving it negative attention, and it's not going to go away no matter what you do. But it's not going to stop doing what it's doing as long as it's at least getting some of what it's wanting to get. Basically, your internal gadfly makes a nuisance of itself. It gets negative attention. So it didn't really get what it wanted, but it came close enough that it's not going to quit doing it. That part of your mind has become addicted to being a nuisance. Because that's the secret of addiction, is that you can never get enough of something that almost works.
That was good. That was good. That worked.
Anybody else? Peter.
Well, I'd just like to follow up on that. When you have this gadfly, what I understood you said is that it's never going to go away. Because when we do our meditation training, that self-talk will die down.
Mm-hmm.
But during the day, I haven't had the experience of it going away, I have to say. And so are you saying there's no need to have an intention for that to go away, but that the intention can be to, as you say, treat it with compassion, aim that it's going to be a helpful member of the team?
Right. Yes. When I was speaking, I was saying that part of her mind is not going to go away, but it doesn't need to keep being a gadfly.
Do you mean a gadfly is something that verbalizes?
Well, that's not even necessarily the form it takes. A gadfly, the term gadfly really refers to something that is a nuisance, right? Okay. It's something that's, and then Socrates referred to himself as a gadfly because he prided himself on the way he taught was to make a nuisance of himself by asking uncomfortable questions that would force a person to let go of their mistaken views and understand things differently. So he took the gadfly, which is just purely a nuisance, nothing else, and then used it as a metaphor for himself as a gadfly with a purpose, with a wholesome purpose. Okay? So when we think of this part of Chris's mind that bothers her, and maybe the part of your mind that engages in a certain kind of self-talk that you find really annoying, you can see it just as a gadfly. But you have to understand, from its side, it's a Socratic gadfly. It's a Socratic gadfly. It may not have the skill and the wisdom that Socrates did, but it thinks it does, or at least it wants to pretend that it does. So at least it has the intention. Its intention is not just to be a nuisance. And the thing is that, yes, you can, through love and compassion, you can take that part of yourself, stop viewing it as a nuisance, but as something that is potentially valuable and useful, and especially get rid of the idea that you can get rid of it, because it's part of you. So it's something that's potentially valuable and useful. It just needs some guidance.
So if you have the voice in your head that says, "Oh, I think I should help her out," then that's all good, isn't it? You wouldn't want to get rid of that, even if you could.
Yeah, right.
And then at the moment, though, you've got, if it's being a nuisance, then would that be the time to ignore it in a positive way? Would that be the time to direct your attention to, say, the breath or to a part of the body and allow it.
Allow it to be there. Let it come, let it be there. And if it goes away, that's nice, but you're not trying to make it go away or even hoping that it does.
Thank you.
You might appreciate this, okay? You may have heard that the way to deal with your personal demons is to love them. You have to learn to love your demons.
Right.
And what we're talking about here, this is exactly what the story of Bhimasambhava is about. So when Buddhism was trying to become established in Tibet, there were great problems. Now, the way the story comes down to us, you have to understand this is mythologized. Actually, we started rewatching some of Joseph Campbell's stuff. You ever watched Joseph Campbell's Power of
read the books.
It's wonderful, powerful stuff, and it's so good. Okay, so this is a mythical story. So everything is metaphorical. Okay, so Buddhism was trying to be established in Tibet. So they'd start to build a temple. And then the local deities and demons and everything else they'd cause an earthquake or a fire or a hailstorm. You know, they'd cause things to happen, right? And so they couldn't make any progress at all. This kept happening over and over again. So they went and found Bhimasambhava, went to India, found Bhimasambhava, the great sorcerer, magician, powerful, you know, and they said, please, you got to help us. And he said, okay. And so he packs up and he travels to Tibet. And they were expecting him to come in and destroy, subdue, vanquish, conquer all of these deities and demons. He didn't. No. He came in and he seduced them to the Dharma. He said, he converted them from being these beings that prevented the Dharma from being established to being protectors of the Dharma. So that's what you have to do with these parts of yourself that are problematic. You have to treat them in exactly the same way that Bhimasambhava treated the deities and the demons who resisted the introduction of Buddhism into Tibet. Because after all, you're trying to take the community of your mind, right? You're trying to introduce the Dharma into the community of your mind. But there's a lot of really powerful, well-established, been around for a long, long time, and used to being in charge parts of yourself. And they don't let go easily. They are the demons of lust and anger and hatred and, the whole list. I don't need to recite it. And they're there, and they're in you. And if you think you're going to conquer them and vanquish them and destroy them and banish them, you've got a lot of suffering ahead. Yeah.
It seems to me that these guys, these baddie dudes, guys who are in control and gals. Not baddie, just disruptive.
Disruptive, yeah.
To the establishment of the Dharma, in the community. It seems like it must become clear at some point. They have something to gain from establishing the Dharma in the community. Do we have to find out what that is ourselves?
Yeah. Well, exactly. You have to discover for yourself, and remember yourself is all these different parts.
Right?
So you have to demonstrate to all these different parts of yourself that that the practice of the Dharma produces exactly what all these parts of yourself have been wanting all along, but they've been going about it in the wrong way.
That happy feeling.
The bliss, the true happiness, the true joy. But yeah, that's the thing. All these different parts of yourself that think that all of their suffering comes from things that happen to them from the outside. They don't get what they want. They lose what they have, what they like. They think their suffering comes from the outside. They likewise think that their happiness comes from the outside, that getting things makes them happy. Being treated in a particular way makes them happy. And it's to discover that that's not where happiness comes from, and that's not where suffering comes from, and that this is the path to the true end of suffering and discovering true happiness. So you have to demonstrate to all the different parts of yourself that that's the wrong path. It doesn't work. That's the path of addiction. You can never get enough of something that doesn't quite work. Right? Never get enough of something that almost satisfies. You know, the pleasure you get from eating chocolate cake, the pleasure that you get from, I mean, there's so many things in the world that provide pleasure, right? But if your happiness depends on that little burst of pleasure that you get from some of these things in the world, that happy, it's shallow, doesn't have any depth to it. It certainly isn't peaceful, because it's already disappearing even when you get hold of it. There is another much greater happiness. This is what the Buddha talks about in there's the Sunyata and the Mahasunyata Sutras. He talks about the different kinds of happiness. Okay? And the ordinary happiness, the feel good, jump up and down kind of happiness, is that's the least of all of the happinesses. The more sublime happinesses come from the total contentment. The happiness that you get from getting something you want is only a shadow of the happiness that comes from wanting nothing. You see, the momentary, incomplete, temporary contentment that comes from the satisfaction of a desire is nothing compared to the happiness, the bliss, the serenity that comes from having no desire. The difference between the temporary satisfaction of a desire and the desirelessness. And you have to discover that for yourself. You have to realize that for yourself. And it's a comparison. So you already got lots of data. You've had lots of experience with getting the little short-term exciting happiness. Now what you've got to do is to start having some experience that comes from this much more deep, profound. You have to discover for yourself the bliss that comes from desirelessness, from contentment, from fulfillment. And that is ultimately the happiness that comes from total contentment, total fulfillment. This is what we want, right? This is what we want. So you have to learn not to chase after these little illusions. And most especially to realize that every time you chase after these little illusory happinesses, it makes the happiness that you really want a little harder to get at. There's some people that have trouble understanding, and this is worth thinking about. This is worth contemplating. It is not immediately obvious. And many people, when they first hear this idea, are ready to jump up and start arguing right away. That the complete absence of suffering is the maximum possible happiness. That happiness and suffering are on two ends of a scale. And that the absence of suffering isn't some place in the middle. It's rather the only place that suffering is totally gone is at this end of the spectrum. From all the way from total suffering and no happiness to total happiness and no suffering, everywhere in between, you've got a mix, right? And the total absence of suffering, the total absence of that mind-generated aspect of dukkha equals the ultimate possible happiness, satisfaction, bliss, the sublime bliss. So it's worth thinking about, because you may well have been of the idea, okay, once I'm rid of suffering, that's fine, but then how do I go about getting the bliss? But you have it. When you've done the one, you've got the other. Pass the microphone back to Barbara.
I think we talked about this once before, how easy it was. It was easier for the monks in the monastery because they gave up everything and existed on alms. We can't do that. So you're getting rid of suffering, but you still have to put food on the table. You still have to pay the rent. You still have to do these things that sometimes you'd rather not have to do.
Yeah.
And put up with those. So I think that makes it much more difficult to get rid of the suffering and find this bliss when you have these obligations of raising children, working.
Well, you're absolutely correct that the life of a lay person creates many more obstacles, that many more challenges, not the least of which is that if you understand this Dharma, okay, and you're trying to live this Dharma, as a lay person, you're living this Dharma surrounded by people who have no understanding of it at all, and who think that the pursuit of pleasures and the destruction of things that are unpleasant is the way. So it's really hard for you to, it's a real challenge. So that is the obstacle of being a layperson. So if you can go off to a monastery, you're at least surrounded by people who have some understanding of the Dharma and who are trying to do the same thing that you are. Now, in terms of, you know, as the Buddha put it, the life of a layperson is very dusty, right? So a lot more so than the life of a wandering mendicant. But the life of a wandering mendicant isn't a rose garden either. There's insects and snakes, and there's not enough food, and they're sleeping in the cold, and they're being drenched in the rain, and they're having no place to go for shelter. Monastery is a little bit better than that because it provides a shelter and things like that. But then you got to get along with all these other people, and then food has to be grown, and then meals have to be prepared. And a lot of people, you know, if you go to modern monasteries, you find most of the monks are doing the same kind of work and dealing with the same kind of social hassles that everybody else did. So their one advantage is that at least they're in an environment where everybody else at least is on the same project. Now, I like to give Geshe Dorje the credit for this particular statement. I had a conversation with him, and basically to the effect that it's an easier path to be a monastic, but it's a more powerful path if you do it in the world as a lay person. It's much easier as a monastic to go part way and be satisfied. Life in the world won't let you get away with that. Every time you think, okay, it's pretty good, this is enough, life comes along and gives you a kick in the butt. So, yes, it's a more difficult path, but it's a more powerful path. You're
welcome. To go back to the scale of contentment, happiness, and suffering on the one hand, It seems to me, and I think you've spoken of this in the past, that an important factor is to appreciate when we have this kind of happiness and this contentment, this genuine feeling, or comparatively have more contentment and appreciate that. I think there's some members of the team feel that that's quite indulgent, and maybe that's the puritanical kind of, you know, habit there. I just like to hear you say what you feel on this, but is it, can I be really quite clear about this, that to take the time to appreciate the contentment is a good, a very good thing worth the time.
It's absolutely, it is a very good thing. Okay. And the other thing that I think is very helpful to understand is that when you've achieved the goal of the path, when you've become a Buddha, that you still experience pleasure and pain. Becoming a Buddha does not keep you from experiencing pleasure and pain, but it totally changes the way you experience pleasure and pain. For an ordinary person, pain is the word that means physical discomfort. If a Buddha steps on a thorn, it produces physical discomfort, just like in anybody else. But as the Buddha described it, when a worldling steps on a thorn, it's like being shot with two arrows. There's the physical unpleasantness, but then there's the mind's reaction to it. And all of the suffering comes in the second part, the second arrow. It's the mind's reaction to it. There need be absolutely no suffering in response to physical pain. That a Buddha still experiences pain, a Buddha still experiences pleasure as well. That there's a difference in the way the Buddha experiences pleasure. He experiences pain with no suffering, physical discomfort with no suffering. He experiences pleasure with no attachment, which means that he experiences the pleasure more fully than any worldling ever possibly could. To experience pleasure with no attachment, no clinging, no grasping, no sense that it's going to go away and trying to hold on to it. When you have a pleasant experience, and tell me if this isn't true, that when you're taking the first bite of chocolate cheesecake, you're already living in the future of the second bite and the end of the cheesecake. You're not totally there. So the difference of the Buddha is just there with the pleasure of the first bite of the cheesecake. And the fifth or sixth bite of the cheesecake, it's not as good, right? For Buddha, that doesn't matter. For the rest of us, it makes us want to eat the rest of the cheesecake faster to see if we can get back to that first bite experience. Which doesn't work, by the way. We just get fat. But that's the other thing, is that, you are hardwired to prefer the pleasant over the unpleasant. If you want to succeed in meditation, definitely hold in mind, be aware of the pleasant aspect, how nice your body feels. You know, even if your knee hurts, some other part of your body that feels really good. Your mind, when you achieve a period of relaxed, pleasant, calm, peacefulness, by all means, take the time to savor that, enjoy that. Because that's how you send the message to these other parts of your mind to say, nah, we'd be having a lot more fun if we were doing something else, right? They get the message that, oh, maybe this isn't so bad after all. This works too, right? The same thing with the practice of the Dharma. You know, helping others does make you feel good. Generosity does make you feel good. Acting out of love does make you feel good. Feeling love makes you feel good, right? Of course, you could blame the other person. Why don't they be more lovable? If they were, I could love them, and then I'd feel good. So it's all their fault that I don't. You know. But loving feels good. And so by all means, you know, anything that is producing a wholesome sense of pleasure, satisfaction, happiness, that's what you want to that's what you want to be fully aware of. That's what you want to reinforce. That's the making of a good karma. So, you know, do a kindness for somebody. And when you feel good, you know, it would be terrible to say to yourself, oh, I shouldn't feel good about this. No, feel good about it. The more good you feel about it, the more likely you are to do another kindness to somebody else on another occasion. And not only that, the more you're going to allow yourself to enjoy the satisfaction that that generates in. Okay. I think that's enough for today. Thank you.